This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
We made it. The year is just about over, and it was a year with a lot of loud politics. But how many Americans really understand the system behind the politics? There's been a call for a greater emphasis on civics education in the U.S. We spoke about that earlier this year with an author who says the only way to bridge the education gap between the rich and inner city schools is to realize that there's also a gap in those students' life experiences.
We know that some kinds of citizens in the United States have a lot more power than other kinds of citizens.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, why schools should say no citizen left behind. We'll also find out why a group known for farm life and education is building robots, and spend an academic minute figuring out why we remember some things better than others. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. While teaching at an all-black middle school in Atlanta, Mayira Levinson realized that students' individual self-improvement may not necessarily enable them to overcome their profound marginalization within American society. She says this is because of a civic empowerment gap that is as shameful and as anti-democratic as the academic achievement gap targeted by her book, No Citizen Left Behind. Mayira Levinson is an associate professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We spoke recently, and I pointed out that each chapter of the book is prefaced with a story from her experience. I asked why she structured the book that way.
Oh, that's a great question. In part, I discovered that people responded the most, they were the most interested in stories I had to tell. And also, I went into thinking about the theory and the social science behind the book through the stories, through the experiences. Also, as it happened, I was at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study the first year that I was working on this book, and my next-door neighbor was a documentary filmmaker, and she was just extraordinary at thinking about how to use stories to explore bigger themes and issues. And so she really encouraged me to work that way.
In the book, the emphasis is on civics, and there's something missing in the civics education in the schools you were dealing with. What do you see as what was missing? And first of all, let's start by how would you define civics education?
Civics education, as we traditionally understand it, is pretty deadly. When we think about civics, we probably think about some teacher droning on, potentially when we're in 12th grade government, about how a bill becomes a law, about the three branches, things that feel just totally distant from our day-to-day lives.
I slept through a couple of those classes, yes.
Well, if you were sleeping, you were doing better than, many students who throw paper wads instead,
okay,
or,
yes.
Just turn up the music on their headphones. Exactly. So I hope that we can start to think about civic education in a very different context, as one that really empowers young people to get involved, helps them develop the knowledge that they need to be effective and appropriate civic actors. But usually, that may include how a bill becomes a law or the three branches of government. That's clearly important, but really learning that in the context of actually doing real work in the world, potentially not learning how a bill becomes a law in Congress initially, but thinking, all right, well, how does legislation, say, move through the city council? How does a school-based policy get developed? Why is it that the local park has a rule against skateboarding? And how can I and my friends work together to change that so that skateboarding is allowed on certain hours at certain days? How can I think about the needs of all users of the park? If we start thinking in that way, working small, but about issues that young people really care about, that will actually get them much more engaged in some of the bigger issues that civics teachers have admirably tried to take on, but usually with notably ill effect.
The schools you were dealing with were mainly minority schools. That was where your experience was. And you talk about the civic empowerment gap in the students. What do you mean by that?
The civic empowerment gap refers to the fact that we know, political scientists have known, members of the general public have known for years and years, that some kinds of citizens in the United States have a lot more power than other kinds of citizens. Those who are wealthier have much, much more power than those who are poorer. Those who have higher levels of education, who are native English speakers, who are native-born citizens as opposed to naturalized citizens, and often who are white as opposed to citizens of color, all have a disparate amount of power in our democracy. And that actually makes us not a democracy. We are not a democracy if you can point to certain classes of citizens and say, oh, well, yes, their voices will be heard more. They're much more likely to be contacted by a public official, asked to deliver testimony, contacted for a vote, if they're, you know, more likely to be quoted in the newspaper or be taken seriously. That is not the feature of a democracy in which we are all supposed to have, and you know, one person, one vote, an equal power to help shape our society. And No Citizen Left Behind, my book, tries to explain how the civic empowerment gap is a feature of our society that for some reason we currently treat as perfectly natural and normal. It may be unfortunate, but what can we do about it? And it says, you know, no, it's not normal. It's not natural. There are things we can do about it, just like the academic achievement gap, where it used to be the case also that we kind of accepted that, say, the average black 12th grader read at the same level as the average white 8th grader, and we would say, oh, well, what can we do about it? Of course, different cultures, different, you know, amount of print in the home, whatever. And we no longer think that's acceptable. We now say, no, schools in the United States have an obligation to educate all children so that they can achieve at high levels academically. And the argument in No Citizen Left Behind is that schools also have an obligation to educate all children so that they can achieve and participate and be empowered civically and politically, also at high levels.
You illustrate this with a story in the book where you talk about a group of your students who were competing in an academic bowl type of quiz competition against a whiter school. And some of the questions just had no meaning to your students. And you must imagine that the people who came up with those questions never even gave that a second thought.
I think that's right. So that the specific thing that were one of the specific areas in which my students stumbled was that they didn't know who Kurt Cobain was, the lead singer of Nirvana, who had committed suicide a couple of years before. And, you know, it doesn't matter if they know who Kurt Cobain is in any generalized sense. But it does matter that they have the cultural capital of those who are in power and are in charge. I was teaching entirely African-American students, almost all of whom were living at or below the poverty line. And when they were competing against this group of kids who were a much whiter team and a wealthier team in Atlanta, the fact that those kids did know who Kurt Cobain was and my students did not matters insofar as those students statistically were the ones much more likely to be in power in a few years, and where my students' apparent ignorance, you know, as far as they were concerned, would be a matter of disdain or ridicule, or, you know, therefore just not their listening to my students. My students were smart, funny, passionate, had great ideas. They really want to improve the community around them, their own, you know, themselves, their families. And if they don't have the tools with which to enter the halls of power and work with diverse others, then they are really going to be stymied in life, and they're going to continue living in a nation that is less democratic and offers them less opportunities than it should.
What do you see as the solution to this? I mean, schools can just do so much, but they can change the kids or maybe educate the kids in a different way. They certainly can't change the attitudes that are out there in the world they're about to enter.
No, that's right. And so the schools need to both help students understand the world in which they are going to enter and give them tools to work within the world as it currently exists. And so, say, I talk about teaching kids how to code switch, how to move from the cultural references, the language, the dress, the looks, the everything of whatever their home culture is, their home community, to one that will give them power in other communities and other cultures and other settings, and how to do that not by telling them, oh, this is right and you're wrong, right, that your way of life is ghetto or bad and this, you know, this way of presenting yourself is more proper and good, but to say, look, this is what you need to do in order to have power here. This is how you need to sound in order to be taken seriously. Whether or not that's fair or right or appropriate, it is the way it is, and so now learn how to work within this. but at the same time also help young people develop a lot of skills so that they can transform the world around them and make it a more just place. Many of these kinds of things do not require extra resources on the part of schools. It doesn't require that schools suddenly spend a lot more time teaching civics than they are currently doing. A lot of what I talk about in the book, you know, I was a teacher for 8 years in the Atlanta and Boston public schools, and these schools serving mostly low-income kids of color, is the ways in which schools right now reinforce the disempowerment, the disaffection, the sense of alienation of low-income kids of color, because we stamp down on them. We do not allow them to express their voices. We do not give them opportunities for leadership. We do not give them opportunities even to discuss things they care about. And so many of my proposals are ways in which especially urban schools can simply change their cultures so that young people are treated with respect, they are taken seriously, they are given opportunities to speak up in class and speak their mind and be challenged by others and have to marshal evidence. And then also they're given opportunities actually to practice citizenship, to be citizens time and time again, so that they gain the knowledge and the skills and the identities as people who can make a difference and can be taken seriously. That's just so important.
My next question, I don't even know that there's a real answer to this beyond speculation, but do you think the election of Barack Obama helps or hurts? I mean, I would say it might hurt just because, well, look, we don't need to help these kids anymore. A black man got elected president. It can be done now. We've done all that we need to do.
There was certainly a lot of writing in the first couple of years, not just writing, but, you know, on the media and so forth, about our living in a post-racial world. And I think that clearly the evidence is that we do not live in a post-racial world under any circumstances, let alone a post-racial political world. In that respect, I think it does hurt to some extent if people look at this and say, oh, well, the problem is solved, right? We have one black man as president, and so therefore we are going to ignore the shocking paucity of black men or women in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, in governorships, in mayoral positions, in the city council, all over. And we just the lack, and not just black, but, you know, citizens of many, many races and ethnicities. It's still a very, very white, upper middle class and rich world out there if you want to have civic and political power. Barack Obama clearly helps insofar as he has convinced many that it is possible for citizens of color, in fact, to contribute to the world in a positive way in positions of power. It's not quite as frightening. He stands as a role model for many, many kids of all, you know, races and ethnicities, but especially for kids of color. But at the same time, he's somewhat demoralizing to young people themselves in that, of course, he has not been able to solve their problems. And so to the extent that, you know, he was sort of invested with this heroic stature. And lo and behold, it's still hard to get a job, right? I mean, it's still the case that there are potholes in one's streets, and, you know, it's impossible to figure out how to pay for college, means that in some cases, young people end up feeling even more discouraged than they did before.
Still to come, more of our conversation about citizenship with Mihira Levinson, author of No Citizen Left Behind. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1162. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Mihira Levinson, Associate Professor of Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of the book No Citizen Left Behind. I mentioned that there's a lot about heroes and role models in the book and asked just how important they are.
I think that heroes are really important for symbolizing the kind of country we want to be and the kinds of people we could become, but that ultimately role models, much more ordinary individuals who are not heroic, are really the more important ones we should be learning about, meeting, and teaching about with young people. The problem with heroes like, you know, say Martin Luther King, is first of all, he was killed for his actions. And a lot of my students said to me, quite understandably, you know, Dr. Levinson, I don't want to be killed for this, right? And that's perfectly reasonable. Also, heroes like Martin Luther King, like Rosa Parks, they just feel unattainable, right? How could I be somebody like that? I can't be, and so I will admire them, but that doesn't mean I'm going to change my own behavior in any way. Whereas when we meet role models, people who are like us, who live in our communities, who have problems, who have kids, who we see at the local baseball field or on the bus, but who are also doing admirable work, that feels much more attainable. And then teachers can bring those role models in and have those role models explicitly teach kids, look, this is how I deliver a speech. This is how I mobilize others to work on behalf of something I cared about. This is what I have done, and here's how you could do it too, not necessarily on my issue, but on your issue. And it's really empowering to young people to meet people who they feel that they could be like and whom they actually do like, and then learn these very concrete skills and techniques that they can then apply themselves. We did this in my classroom for a few years, and it was so exciting to kids when then they meet such role models, say, at the neighborhood diner or on the bus, and they would come in and they say, Dr. Levinson, I just met Counselor Yoon on the bus, and he said blah, 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 and I told him this, I was doing this, and that's just so exciting and empowering. And I think it's also really important to recognize that most of the things that we want to have happen, we can't do on our own. We are, you know, individual power is limited. Yes, there are some extraordinary individuals out there who can change the world themselves, but most of us have to work with others collectively to make a difference.
Mihira Levinson is an associate professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Her new book is called No Citizen Left Behind. It's published by Harvard University Press. One organization that's always stressed citizenship education is 4-H. But when you think of 4-H, you probably think of kids raising cattle or chickens or hogs and competing for blue ribbons at the state fair. And while the program does historically focus on agriculture, as more Midwestern youth are growing up in urban areas, it's developing some other angles. This year at the Iowa State Fair, 4-H changed things up with a robotics challenge. Kathleen Masterson from Harvest Public Media reports.
So do you think we need a touch sensor or treads to go up the ramp or use an arm to drop it?
The toxic teens from St. Augustine School in Des Moines are debating just how to build their robot. It's just moments after the 8 youth teams have received their challenge. The task? Get the robot to transport a tiny beanbag up a cornhole ramp and then deposit it into one of 3 holes, with the top one worth the most points.
I'm building the NXT robot since it needs to have like a little support system so it can have the stuff it's using, like the wheels and all the motors and sensors.
Peter Kappert of the Toxic Teens is working with his sister Claire to build the moving components they'll attach to the small robot body, which is about the size of a Walkman. Then they program it using software on their laptop. This is the second year of the Brattney 4-H Robotics Challenge at the State Fair. The number of teams has more than doubled, and this year they had to turn some teams away. Holly Bignall works in Iowa State University Extension's Science, Engineering, and Technology Division and runs the competition.
Well, this is definitely a really quickly growing segment of 4-H, is this robotics specifically, but also just science, engineering, technology in general. It's something that really appeals to urban youth, and we're definitely trying to reach more urban youth.
Bignall says a big part of the goal is to increase the number of youth interested in science, engineering, and technology.
The robotics is really a team activity, and there's lots of different roles for different people. So we really try and encourage the adults that work with the kids not to present it as just something that the kids who are into computer programming will want to do, because that's not the case at all. I mean, some kids are really more into the sort of figuring out the mechanisms and the gear ratios and all those types of things.
And that teamwork, vision, and creativity really kicks into play in the other half of the robotics competition, the junk drawer challenge.
We have like ruler, a propeller, a couple colored pencils, some sort of weird necklace thing, a couple straws.
Basically everything that we have will help us finish it.
That's the atomic fireballs from Dallas County pouring over the odds and ends they have to build their machine. It has to set off 4 mousetraps, each glued to the corner of a poster-sized board. There's a whole range of elaborate constructions. Some teams are building windmill-like blades out of cardboard or taped-together pencils. Then they're attaching them to a small motor so they'll whip around and pop the mousetraps. Over at another table, the Lego medics are devising a giant tube to set off a chain reaction of marbles down chutes.
So, one marble is going to come down one chute and hit the mousetrap. And if we're lucky, we might be able to get in and set off another mousetrap in sequence.
And after the 3 hours are up, the teams bring their creations to the stage and put them to the test. 2 teams at a time face off, and they have 90 seconds to get their robot or machine to run the task.
3, 2, 1, Lego!
Their teammates groan and cheer from the audience as beanbags slide into place, or sometimes land frustratingly close to the hole without sliding in. In the end, the grand prize goes to the exuberant Lego medics. The Toxic Teens win the Junk Drawer Challenge, and the STEMgineers win the Robot Programming Contest. Jay Staker of Iowa State University Extension Science, Engineering, and Technology says they're really trying to grow their focus on science.
I think it's our future. Most of our youth now live in urban counties. And with that, we have to have great opportunities for these kids to see themselves in 4-H.
I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
Are you the type of person who can remember what you had for dinner on your 25th birthday but have no idea where your keys are? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. There's no more frustrating feeling than being unable to remember something that is on the tip of your tongue. Michelle Miller, department chair and professor of psychology at Northern Arizona University, explains exactly what's going on when our memory fails us.
In my research on memory, I've rarely run into anyone who claimed to have a good memory. Many people are interested in improving their memory, but they have limited understanding of how to do that, or they just believe it's hopeless. Memory isn't there just to absorb mountains of information, but to selectively encode only those things that will help us survive in our environment. Your bank account number or a new equation you're trying to learn in math class isn't going to jump out as being the kind of important information that we ought to retain. It just doesn't have an emotional kick. One kind of memory that seems to give almost everyone difficulties is prospective memory. This is memory for things we need to do in the future, like remembering to pick up a gallon of milk on the way home. People tend to forget these kinds of intentions very rapidly and fail to retrieve them at the right time. And the reasons have to do with how we rely on cues for memory. You can try to improve this side of memory through really focusing on those cues, such as when you sit down in your car, think of milk. But in many situations, this can still be dicey, so the safest thing to do is rely on aids like checklists or cell phone alerts. Proper names are another common memory issue. We forget a specific name and enter into the state we call tip of the tongue. Most scientists agree that the issue here isn't with losing the knowledge of the person per se, but a temporary inability to access the sounds associated with that knowledge. So rather than ruminating on meaningful information about the person, which many people tend to do, try running through each letter of the alphabet to trigger the sounds, which may cause the name to pop up in memory. And if all else fails, remember that this is a problem that becomes common with age and is more annoying than being any sign of a serious condition.
That was Michelle Miller of Northern Arizona University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.